Cool. Well, thank you very much. So I have to apologize. Somebody sicked a damn cold on me, and then I spent 3 days in California breathing in smoke. So I basically sound like a bad Johnny Cash tribute band right now. But I'm going to, hopefully the microphone will help with that, right? So what I'm going to talk about today is sort of the more astrophysics-y side of sort of compact object and sort of gravitational wave mergers. And I always like to start off with this slide because it really shows just how radically our understanding of sort of black hole astrophysics has changed even the last 3 years. So even by 2015, like this was what we knew were the masses of stellar mass black holes, the local universe. It was all from X-ray binaries, all based on X-ray observations. And the masses pretty much went from maybe about 5 solar masses to 15 solar masses. There were a few claimed detections of 20, 25 solar mass black holes, but there were such huge uncertainties that nobody really believed them. But then, of course, LIGO comes around and in 2015, detects the first heavy black hole of 30 solar masses. And since then, it's continued to detect more and more black holes, which seem to inhabit an entirely new region of parameter space that we didn't really know about beforehand. Now we're talking about black holes with masses of 30 solar masses, 35, maybe even 40 solar masses, and merging to produce even more and more massive objects. So I'm going to start off with just going back to the first one, GW150914. I think everybody pretty much in astrophysics has seen this plot at least once by now, I hope. And the real question that drives a lot of what I do and a lot of what astrophysicists have been looking at with this is, how do you actually form 30 plus 30 solar mass binary black hole mergers? We know reasonably well how to get a massive black hole. We understand this from stellar evolution. You just start off with a massive star, you turn the crank. As long as the metals in the star are relatively low, so the fraction of the star that's metals is very low, you don't lose a lot of mass to stellar winds. So when the star eventually expands onto the giant branch and then goes supernova, you're left behind with this massive compact object that's 30 or 40 solar masses. That part we understand at least reasonably well. We have a good handle on at least how that works, even if the details are still somewhat unclear. The tricky part is getting these two objects then close enough to where they'll actually merge in a Hubble time and produce gravitational waves. So I start off with these things in a binary. I want to get them down to a 65-ish solar mass object. And I need that to happen in less than the age of the universe. The problem is, if I just integrate the Peters equations and ask how long does that actually take for a circular binary, I need to start this binary off with a separation of like 0.2 AU before it's going to merge within the age of the universe. The problem comes from when I go back to this picture of how the stars evolve. When these things are on the giant branch, they expand to a massive size, something like 20 AU in diameter. For reference, drawn to scale, that means that the surface of this giant would look something like this during the stage of evolution. And so how do I produce this relatively compact binary out of a system that has at some point expanded onto the giant branch in this sort of dramatic fashion? And there's a couple different ways you can go about doing that, and I'm going to talk mostly about the sort of dynamical way of doing that, which sort of leads me to the beginning of my talk. So this is just me and a bunch of people I've been working with, both as a PhD student and then as a postdoc at MIT. I also like to just throw up a slide that shows sort of a lot of the people that have contributed to this throughout the literature. The first paper on this, actually, and it's a pity that Simon left 10 minutes ago, literally, by Simon Portugues-Wart and Steve McMillan in 2000, was sort of one of the earliest estimates of this. It was just a bunch of back-of-the-envelope estimates of binary black hole mergers from globular clusters and galactic nuclei, and they actually came up with a merger rate, just from very simple calculations, that is suspiciously similar to the current LIGO-Virgo merger rates. So I just always like to mention that because it's really cool. But talking more generally now, I'm gonna sort of give an overview on how you actually can form these binary black holes. So the first idea is that you start off with your two massive stars already in a pre-existing stellar binary. And you start them off at a far enough separation that they're not gonna dramatically mess with each other during their phases of evolution. So I start these things off at about 20 AU separation. First star goes supernova, collapses to a black hole. The second star evolves onto the giant branch. And then through some process that we don't fully understand, the envelope of this star actually envelops the compact object that was left behind by the primary. And then through some complicated gastrophysics that we really don't have good constraints on, this common envelope process, it just really tightens the orbit and brings these two objects together while injecting enough gravitational potential energy into the envelope to completely unbind it. Then you're left behind with this sort of compact binary, the core of this giant and the black hole here. The core collapses to a black hole, and I'm left behind with a compact object binary that'll merge within a Hubble time. So as you can imagine, though, there's a lot of uncertainties with this. We don't understand from hydro simulations how the common envelope actually works. We've never, to our knowledge, actually observed it in practice. And you have to hit a very, very thin sort of target for this to work. You have to bring these things in close enough to where they'll merge within a Hubble time, but not so close that they actually merge when the secondary star is a giant. So there's a lot of uncertainties with this, but this is what people in population synthesis generally do. What I'd like to look at is something slightly different, which is this idea that what if you start off with the two stars completely unbound? In this case, of course, you don't have to solve this separation problem because the things can just evolve on their merry way and then eventually collapse down into two compact objects. But the problem is now I need to get these things into a binary. And so if I just, you know, ram these two things past one another in space, you know, positive energy in, positive energy out, I'm not going to have any way to actually form binary from these things. But if I have some way to dissipate that energy, that excess energy and angular momentum, you know, let's say there's a third object nearby that I can dump that onto, then I can actually have, through this complicated three-body encounter, a system there where I form a bound binary system and dump the excess energy onto this sort of interloping particle. Now, as you can imagine, this is a statistically very rare thing. And it doesn't happen, say, in galaxies, because the stellar density in galactic fields is way too low to have three objects come close enough together to undergo these sort of dense encounters, or these sort of complicated encounters. But there are objects out there in space, you know, dense star clusters, where the density of objects is actually high enough that this process can occur, we think, semi-regularly. So this is a globular cluster up here. This is what we generally call the dynamical formation scenario. Now, I've presented this as sort of two competing channels. In reality, of course, there's a whole list of this. This is just a partial sampling of the ways people have theoretically, you know, thunk up to actually get these systems at LIGO was seen. And a lot of these existed before even the first detection, and there's been a proliferation even since then. There is certainly more binary black hole formation theories than there are binary black hole mergers. But most of them typically fall into one of these two categories. Either you start off with a pre-existing stellar binary, or you start off with some sort of dynamical formation in a dense stellar environment. The real question that I'm interested in, though, is can we tell the difference between these things? Can we actually figure out which black holes are coming from what channels, and how can we actually do astrophysics with that? So I'm going to talk about the dynamical formation scenario a little bit more now and give you a sort of an idea of how it actually works. So I've focused for the most part on globular clusters in my work up to now for a few key reasons. One, they're in a way pretty actually easy compared to other systems out there because they're very old and they're very generally massive. And in particular, they're very compact. So while this makes for a lot of difficulty, there's no star formation going on anymore, and there's no gas hanging out in these things. So it's really just a smooth, clean, dynamical in-body problem, where I have to consider the orbits of, say, a million or so particles. Now, these clusters are found in just about every galaxy, and roughly speaking, the number of globules you have scales linearly with the size of your halo mass. So the Milky Way galaxy has, give or take, about 200 globular clusters. Larger galaxies, say like the giant elliptical M87, have tens of thousands of globular clusters. Because they scale pretty well with the halo mass of the galaxy, it's pretty easy to make predictions for how many of things there are in any co-moving region of space.
All systems, there is no more star formation going on, et cetera. Well, if you were to look into those systems, now they are star forming and whatever, are there natural channels to form binaries, or do you believe that they are?
No, so there is. There is star formation that occurs in the local universe, and there is even star cluster formation that occurs in the local universe. This is what we call open clusters, or even superstar clusters, which are things like the progenitors of massive star clusters. And most of those, we think, evacuate sort of their gas after the first few supernova or so, because the shocks essentially blow all the gas out of the cluster. The reason we try to avoid star formation is actually more relevant to nuclear star clusters, because there you have gas continually falling in, giant molecular clouds are being brought in, and you're continuously forming gas in this environment where the mass of the gas actually plays a role in the dynamics. So you have to somehow solve the hydro of this, the star formation part of this, and the dynamics of this all at the same time. And I think that's a really interesting problem, but it's an exceedingly difficult problem. And I don't think anybody's doing a particularly good job of that computationally right now.
We have no good clues out of that.
Not really. And a lot of people have done different work on that. So there's a group out of Columbia and the AMNH that's done work on sort of forming black holes in AGN disks, either from stars that got dragged down into it or stars that formed in the disk. You can induce Kozai oscillations in binaries that are orbiting around a supermassive black hole. Smadar knows, and some of her students have done a lot of work on this. Or you can just treat them as basically souped-up globular clusters that are doing huge amounts of dynamics. The problem is, from a computational perspective, if you want to model a whole one of these things with 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 particles, it's kind of a nightmare. And doing that with any sort of fidelity, especially when we don't have good observational constraints for like the star formation histories, is extremely difficult. I think it's very interesting, but it's, you know, I need a faculty job and like 3 postdocs before I could actually hack at that. So if anybody has any, no. But so if I was talking about black holes and globular clusters even like 10 years ago, people would think I was a little bit crazy, because there really wasn't any observational or theoretical reason to expect to see black holes in globular clusters. It was a pretty good argument originally due to Spitzer. What would happen is, after you form your black holes early on in the cluster, so about 12, 13 billion years ago, you know, that happens on roughly a 10 mega-year timescale. And then on a very rapid timescale, maybe about 100 mega-years or so, these black holes would sink into the center of the cluster due to a process we call dynamical friction. And once there, the argument always was, you know, you have this very compact region of a population of black holes in the center of the cluster. And essentially, the dynamics is going to be dialed up to 11 there. So at that point, you expect all the black holes to eject each other on a very rapid timescale, maybe about a giga year or so. And so that was sort of the prevailing story up until, I would say, the late 2000s, at which point we started getting actual detections of black hole candidates inside globular clusters. So the picture on the left is M22 from Jay Strader's Nature paper. And they actually identified in 2012 2 black hole X-ray binary candidates inside the globular cluster M22. And so if you believe that, which not everybody does, because these are supposedly black hole X-ray binaries in quiescence, but if you believe that, then that means there's probably anywhere from 5 to 100 black holes remaining in M22 that we're not seeing, just because they're not partnered up and they're not accreting gas. Now, this requires a bit of a dark art in terms of comparing X-ray and radio luminosities. But just this year, we got our first radio velocity detection of a black hole in a globular cluster. This is a detection of some object with a minimum M sine I mass of 4.5 solar masses in the globular cluster NGC 3201, which I will readily admit nobody in the community had really heard of before this paper came out. But this basically says that, you know, somewhere in this globular cluster is a non-luminous object with a minimum mass of 4.5 solar masses that has a star orbiting around it. And there's no way that could really be anything but a black hole. Unless it's like a really, really freaky binary neutron star in a triple. And so we know now, you know, from these observations and from improved theoretical work, that there are black holes in globular clusters. So how do I translate that knowledge into forming black hole binaries? So if I go back to this picture where I have these sort of three-body encounters that form these binaries, we know this happens in globular clusters just because the density is high enough that it practically has to. And so I form a binary, and I'm basically left with a single binary black hole in this cluster. And at that point, it's essentially like a giant target. And I'm going to continue to throw objects at this the same way I would, you know, throw particles at a target in a particle accelerator. And in fact, if you're feeling particularly, you know, bold and field theoretic, you can actually express these encounters in terms of Feynman diagrams. So you can actually imagine that I have some bound energetic system, and I'm continuing to throw particles at it. I am not particularly that math happy, so I actually prefer to just do this numerically and sort of see what happens during these encounters. So in this case, I'm throwing a single star or black hole at a binary, and using these sort of numerical techniques, in this case just directly integrating the Newtonian equations of motion, we can actually, you know, watch what happens to these binaries during these encounters. So in this case, I end up with this crazy resonant encounter, and now I form a binary that has essentially gotten kicked out of the encounter and thrown one of the objects out at a greater velocity. Now, there's 2 things that always happen during these encounters. On statistical average, as long as my binary has a greater binding energy than the typical kinetic energy of the stars it's interacting with, the binary will undergo a process we call hardening. Essentially, the semi-major axis of the binary will shrink, and the potential energy from that will get translated into the recoil. So on statistical average, every time I hit one of these binaries with an interloping object, The binary is going to shrink its semi-major axis, and it's going to get a recoil kick from that encounter. The other thing that happens is that, and this just has to do with sort of the way we parameterize these binaries, every time I undergo one of these complicated resonance encounters, I get a new eccentricity drawn from what we call the thermal distribution. So in that case, that's just the probability of having some eccentricity is proportional to E. And so I have this giant binary with separations of maybe tens of AU hanging out in the cluster, and I'm going to continue to throw objects at it. And every time I do, you know, this hardening process means the binary is going to shrink, it's going to get a recoil kick, it's going to throw it out of the cluster, and then essentially dynamical friction is going to bring that binary back into the center of the cluster. This process happens again and again, and every time this happens, there's really two relevant timescales that determines what happens. The first is the typical timescale between successive encounters with an interloping single object. So this you can pretty much guesstimate with a simple n sigma v argument. And it basically, the collisional cross-section goes as essentially the semi-major axis squared times the number density times the velocity dispersion. And then there's this extra term on the right that accounts for gravitational focusing. You know, unlike particle physics particles, these particles actually want to get hit. So I'm drawing particles from a larger sort of annulus in impact parameter space than I would be if gravity wasn't taking hold. And so if I write down typical parameters for a binary, a circular binary, a reasonably high but not unreasonable stellar density, I find that the typical binary single timescale, the timescale between successive encounters, is going to be on the order of a few tens of megayears. In this case, about 40 megayears. The competing timescale to this is the gravitational wave timescale, which goes as the semi-major axis to the fourth power times this weird term in eccentricity. Now, if I plug in the numbers from this, the time for this binary to merge due to gravitational radiation is roughly about 150,000 megayears, or, you know, significantly longer than the age of the universe. And so if I compare these two timescales, you know, the gravitational wave timescale is about 4,000 times longer than the binary single timescale, which means this binary is going to continue to harden and harden, getting greater and greater recoil kicks, until eventually one of those kicks is just going to throw it completely out of the cluster. Now, you'll notice I've done one slightly sketchy thing here, though, which is that I've set the eccentricity of the binary to zero. I've assumed it's a circular binary. And remember from about five slides ago, I said that every time I undergo one of these resonant encounters, I get a new draw from the thermal distribution for my binary eccentricity. And so if I take into account this strong dependence on eccentricity, and I remember that the thermal distribution is a thing, I realize that even 10% of the time, I'm going to get a binary that has an eccentricity of like 0.95 or higher. So that's not unreasonable, even in these purely Newtonian encounters. And at 0.95, this eccentricity term drives the ratio between timescales down to unity. And so now, I've got about an equal chance of having the binary get a recoil kick that throws it out of the cluster, as I do having it merge inside the cluster. And so this process, as you can imagine, is basically going to continue without end until the binary either merges or gets kicked out of the cluster. And what determines when it gets kicked out of the cluster, right, is the escape speed of the cluster. The thing is going to continue getting recoil kicks until it is eventually ejected from the cluster. But you can also imagine that means that more massive clusters are going to have higher escape speeds. So more massive clusters are going to require the binary to be more hard before it gets kicked out of the system. And that's actually a kind of neat part about this, because it's the escape speed of the cluster that determines the typical semi-major axis of these things when they're ejected, which is kind of really neat if you think about it, because we've got these very, very complicated, formally chaotic three-body and four-body encounters, which are very hard to deal with analytically and even pretty tricky to deal with numerically. But what fundamentally determines the physics of this is the bulk properties of the cluster. And so using this knowledge, I can basically ask, you know, what is the optimal cluster mass for producing LIGO sources? And so what I'm plotting up here is on the top left, I'm showing the I just want to use the hockey stick because I figure I have to. You know, it's my first time in Ontario. I figure I should. But so on the top left, I've got the typical distribution of semi-major axes. On the top right, I've got the cumulative probability distribution for in-spiral time. So the Hubble time is right about here. And on the bottom, I'm showing a rough estimate of what the globular cluster mass function is in the local universe. So in this case, I'm looking at pretty small clusters over here on the sort of less massive end of the distribution, and in this case, only about 10% of these binaries are going to merge within a Hubble time. But as I crank up the number of particles, this distribution essentially shifts to the left. and I get tighter and tighter binaries that are being ejected from the cluster, and the in-spiral times correspondingly shift to the left as well. So now I'm getting 30, 40, even 60 or 70% of my binaries are gonna merge within a Hubble time. And if I want something to be ejected from the cluster 10 gigayears ago and merge in the local universe, that's roughly where I want that cumulative distribution to land. And so right at the point where I get to this, I get to that sort of sweet spot, also happens to be roughly the peak of the globular cluster mass function. So it turns out that globulars are sort of uniquely tuned to produce viable gravitational wave sources in the local universe.
Question?
Yeah?
You mentioned that there's a correlation between the scape, the size of the cluster, mm-hmm. and well, the Hardy-Weinberg binary. Is there also a correlation with the eccentricity, residual eccentricity you have?
No, not really, because the eccentricity doesn't enter into the energy of the binary. And so, I mean, what really determines it is you assume that I have the binding energy of the binary, which is just the masses over 2a, and that every time I harden this binary, I'm going to lose maybe about 20 to 40% of my binding energy to the recoil energy. And so every time that happens, I'm essentially shrinking the semi-major axis, but I'm not really touching the eccentricity. The only place where the eccentricity enters into this is whether or not the thing is going to merge in the cluster before another interloping particle comes and messes with it. And so if I get a very high eccentricity, you know, then it's going to merge before it can continue to harden. Excuse me. All right. So what I've been doing for the past few years at sort of the tail end of my PhD and for a lot of my postdoc is sort of asking the question of, you know, if we look at these globular clusters, if we create, you know, high fidelity collisional models of these globular clusters, and we ask what happens, you know, how many binary black holes, what do they look like, where do they merge, what are their masses, you know, what do we get from that's of interest to advanced LIGO? So for doing this, I ended up using this sort of approximate technique for modeling dense star clusters. I know Simon was here a couple of weeks ago and probably talked about this a bit, but the problem with a direct in-body integration of a globular cluster, where I integrate the force, say, of one particle against every other particle, is that it's extremely expensive. The state-of-the-art, one of these simulations, they're called the Dragon simulations, managed to finally do integrate a globular cluster with a million stars forward for 12 gigayears. That was just done a couple of years ago, and it took 13 months of computer wall time. It's an insanely computationally expensive problem. So what we do instead is we assume that most of our stars are essentially on slowly evolving orbits, and that we understand the process of diffusion of these orbits well enough to statistically sample how the orbits are diffusing in phase space. And so what we do is we basically, we follow each of the orbits and their diffusion through the phase space, and then every fraction of the relaxation time, we sample a new position for the particle on its orbit. Because we're doing this on a star-by-star basis, each one of our particles is a star, we can add on as much additional physics as we want. So we can couple our stars to a stellar evolution code. Itself consistently takes things from massive stars to giants to black holes. We can also couple this to a small n in-body integrator, which is what I was showing earlier. and so if the neighboring stars are a binary and a single star, when we sort of do this Monte Carlo scattering, we can actually do this as a realistic, you know, in-body integration. Now I should point out, insert some shameless self-aggrandizement, that when I first started doing this was sort of late 2014, early 2015, and I basically was looking at a bunch of the Monte Carlo models that we had lying around already and asking sort of what was the implications for advanced LIGO. And this is currently the luckiest I've ever been in my professional life, but basically 2 months before the first LIGO detection, we put out our first paper on this, and we actually claimed that from globular clusters, you would expect you would expect roughly about 100 detectable binary black holes per year, and that they would have masses that are typically larger than what you get from stars evolving in isolation. Now, there turns out to be a lot of microphysics that changes that in some of the details, but again, I mean, the implications of this dynamics are somewhat unavoidable. And so, I mean, it was obvious even before the first detection, and this goes back to even Simon and Steve McMillan's estimates in 2000 is that, you know, globular clusters can be a significant contributor to the LIGO-Virgo merger rate. And so if I ask the question, you know, what do the masses look like from these things? I get this distribution that peaks roughly at about 40 solar masses in total mass. So that's roughly about 20 plus 20. And then has this long tail that goes up to 60 solar masses, 80 solar masses. Again, this is the total mass of the binary. But LIGO is more sensitive to black holes that are heavier. So it sees more massive black holes at a greater horizon distance. And so if I convolve this realistic distribution that merges in the local universe with the LIGO sensitivity function, I get this nice, smooth distribution that has a peak at about 50 solar masses in total mass, and a 60 percentile region from about 35 solar masses up to about 65 solar masses. And so a lot of clusters naturally produce these sort of heavy binaries that have been essentially the bread and butter of LIGO so far. And if I plot all the heavy black hole binaries on top of this, they all land roughly within that 60 percentile region. Now, of course, I'm being a little cheeky here because I'm, you know, leaving off the two low-mass black holes that LIGO's detected so far. But, you know, in terms of the heavy stuff that's sort of going to be, I think, the bread and butter of LIGO for the next few years, you know, globular clusters are a very reasonable way to produce these things such that they merge in the local universe. I keep saying local universe because that's what LIGO is probing so far. But one of the things I have been interested in is, you know, how does this work if I expand this onto a cosmological level? So more recently, I decided, you know, we can show that globular clusters can reproduce the masses of what LIGO has seen so far, but can it reproduce them at the same rate? So I decided to basically nab a sort of cosmological simulation from the literature. And so this is taken from a semi-analytic model for globular cluster formation that was sort of worked out by Kareem El-Badri, who's a phenomenal grad student at UC Berkeley. And basically, he combined these sort of halo merger trees that you get from cosmological simulations, where you follow galaxies merging, and you follow the gas flowing into and out of them, and you can sort of analytically track when star formation gets triggered and when cluster formation gets triggered. And he basically asked, you know, if I implement some models for forming dense star clusters in these, and then I just track where the globular clusters, you know, end up as they sort of merge together, what is the history of globular cluster formation, and where are the globular clusters today in the present universe? And so from this, you can actually get, you know, detailed, you know, models for where all of the globular clusters are forming, you know, in what galaxies and at what redshifts. And so if I convolve this with the collisional models that I have, I can get a pretty good cosmologically consistent, or at least cosmologically simulation consistent, idea of what the binary black hole merger rate is as a function of cosmic time. And so what I want to do is try and hit the LIGO rate from this, right? Because we want to be able to explain what LIGO is seeing so far. And the LIGO rate, give or take, varies between two different values. And it depends on what you assume the underlying mass distribution of black holes is. So if you assume the black hole mass distribution is essentially uniform in log, the current LIGO-Virgo merger rate is about 30 per gigaparsec cubed per year. It goes down to about 10, goes up to about 60. If you assume, on the other hand, that black holes follow essentially a Saul-Peter mass function, so minus 2.3 power law in terms of mass, then the merger rate gets much higher. Then it's about 100 per gigaparsec cubed per year, you know, up to 200 or down to 40. I personally lean more towards the uniform and log one, not least of which because there is absolutely no reason, to my understanding, to assume that black holes follow the same mass function as massive stars. But I think when LIGO does this, they're essentially trying to say, all right, we don't know what the underlying mass distribution is, but these are two reasonably good guesses, and the real answer is probably somewhere in the middle. So it's essentially a way of constraining our model uncertainty on what the masses of black holes are. And so if I convolve the collisional models that we have with this clever sort of cosmological model of cluster formation from El-Badri, we get this nice, smooth distribution of binary black hole mergers across cosmic time. So this is a little bit confusing, but what I'm showing here is a couple of plots from a recent paper I did with Avi Loeb, where we essentially tracked what the globular cluster formation, what the globular cluster binary black hole merger rate looks like, and compared it to the merger rates you expect from different formation channels. And so, for globular clusters, you know, you start off at about redshift 8 or so, you actually get to a peak at about redshift 2.5 before decreasing again, you know, post sort of the peak of globular cluster formation in the universe. And so this predicts a sort of local merger rate of about 14 mergers per gigaparsec cubed per year in the local universe. One of the neat things about this that we put out in this paper is that if you're trying to explain, for instance, the total log uniform rate, which is what we do here, then essentially, globular clusters, field binaries, and in this case, stellar triples, which I took from a paper I did with Fabio Antonini, all contribute at roughly the same level. And so you add these three things together, and you get a hypothetical curve for what LIGO's, or the binary black hole merger rate looks like across cosmic time. On the other hand, if you need to explain the entire power law mass estimate, you pretty much have to dial one of these way up in order to explain it. And in this case, we chose the field, the common envelope formation channel, just because it has a fairly large number of uncertainties to it. And so in that case, you end up with one channel essentially dominating over the other ones.
How can you do it for you?
It's a little bit harder. There were actually several papers that came out all within a couple of months that tried to explore sort of how much you could dial up the merger rate. And it's really hard to get it past about 20 or 30 per gigaparsec per year. And actually 30 is pretty difficult. And the reason is, like, there's just a finite amount of black hole. I mean, at some point you're limited by the fact that we know roughly what the co-moving density globular clusters is. It's about 1 per megaparsec cube. And we know just from the IMF how many black holes they should have had. And so if you assume that maybe about 2 out of every 5 black holes that are ejected from a cluster will form a black hole binary, there's a fundamental upper limit you can put on how many, what the contribution is from globular clusters in the local universe. So it could, if let's say that the uniform and log rate is correct, which I'm kind of inclined to think that's closer to the actual truth, and once the LIGO catalog paper comes out, we will have a better idea for sure, or so the LIGO collaboration members keep telling me. In that case, I think it's kind of interesting because you have all of these formation channels essentially operating at the same level. And that, I think, is much more interesting from an astrophysics perspective because it gives us a chance to really sort of probe multiple different aspects of sort of cosmological star formation, dynamics, and everything else. And like that gives us a much better use of gravitational wave astronomy.
Sorry, I got confused with something you just said about the binary being ejected from the cluster. Why do you care? Do you think it could merge within the clusters?
Oh no, it could merge within the cluster. I was more making that as sort of a. So I mean, you know, basically that every binary once it forms in the cluster is going to continue to harden until it either gets ejected or merges. The majority of them are going to get ejected, but it's a weak majority, like maybe 2/3. But the thing is, you need interloping objects to essentially harden the binary to the point where it gets ejected, and because. So imagine I have. A 10 plus 10 binary black hole and a tensile mass black hole, and I undergo one of these hardening encounters and I get a recoil kick from that. From the center of mass frame, I'm going to eject 2 or 3 of the single objects before the binary gets a recoil speed enough to eject it from the cluster. And so you can show from in-body experiments that for every binary that you eject, you also eject about 3 or 4 single objects with it. And so if all of these encounters are happening between black holes, and those are the ones that can most efficiently harden these things, and for every binary you eject from the cluster, you're also taking with you about 3 or 4 single black holes. And since you only start off with maybe about a few thousand, like a couple of thousand black holes at the outside of things at early times, there's a finite number of black holes in globular clusters per co-moving space for you to play around with. But in order to do any of this, right, in order to actually break this apart into different contributions and do any sort of astrophysics, we have to be able to tell the difference between these two things. And that's what I'm going to talk about for sort of the last 20 minutes or so. This was an hour-long talk, right? OK, cool. Probably should have asked that at the beginning. So we have roughly about, there's a lot of different properties that binary black holes have. And there's a lot of different properties that you would expect from different formation scenarios. And so for early on, we were all sort of convinced that you could use maybe the masses or the merger rates or the mass ratios between the two objects as a way to discriminate these formation channels. Unfortunately, it looks like most channels can produce roughly the same masses, and they can produce pretty much that everything that LIGO has seen so far. The merger rates, again, are also relatively flexible, and any good theorist can dial those up or down up to at least within the LIGO error bars. And the mass ratios, somewhat obnoxiously, tend to prefer unity from both formation channels, which is very unhelpful. And so those are out. So what I'm going to talk about instead is a couple of different ways, sort of outlying options that we can use to sort of discriminate these different formation channels and try to figure out which or how many black holes are coming from single black holes in globular clusters and how many are coming from binaries in galactic fields. Yeah, pardon me real quick. And so instead I'm going to talk about a few different ways that sort of dynamical formation imprints a signature into the gravitational waveforms itself. And that mostly comes from the way dynamical formation influences either the spins or the eccentricities of these objects. I'm going to revisit masses at the end, because it turns out these in-cluster mergers give you a sort of unique way to form a different mass, to sort of probe a different mass regime that you can get from just isolated binary stars. But starting off with the spins, so I've drawn here just a little diagram of sort of what the spin configuration is of a binary black hole. The spins are interesting because the spins themselves actually, you know, they actually directly couple to the gravitational waveform. So if I start off with a binary black hole that has intrinsic spins that are aligned with the orbit, I get this nice smooth waveform that just undergoes, you know, sort of a natural chirp. But imagine I slowly rotate those spins into the plane. What happens is the waveform actually shifts, and now suddenly I have these amplitude modulations in the wave. And what's causing that is actually the precession of the binary that's induced by rotating the spins down into the plane. So if the spins are in the plane, suddenly I have a difference between the orbital angular momentum and the total angular momentum of the binary. And due to Lenz-Tierney precession and other forms of spin-orbit coupling, I will actually see the orbit appear to precess in space about the total angular momentum of the system. Now, LIGO is, you know, at a basic level more sensitive to binaries that are face-on versus edge-on. And so as this binary precesses around the total angular momentum, I get these nice amplitude modulations in the waveform. At the same time, if I continue rotating the spins and take them down to where they're essentially anti-aligned with the orbit, you know, the amplitude modulations go away, but suddenly I have this huge, this very, very distinct phase shift in the waveform, which has to do with the fact that, you know, when the spins are aligned, the sort of innermost stable circular orbit of the binary is much closer in, and so essentially the binary gets to a closer separation before it actually plunges and merges. If they're anti-aligned, the ISCO is significantly farther out, the binary in spiral terminates much further out, and I get essentially a much shorter waveform with a very distinct frequency change. Now, unfortunately, LIGO is not that sensitive to amplitude modulations. It really measures frequency very well. So LIGO, you can imagine, is not really going to measure whether or not spins are lying in the plane, but it will be able to measure whether or not they're aligned or anti-aligned very, very well. And so what do the spins look like from these different formation channels? Well, from isolated binary evolution, if I assume that I start off with the spins of the stars aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the binary, you know, the only way to misalign these things is actually by torquing the orbit during the supernova case. So I have the first supernova goes off, it essentially torques the orbit and misaligns the orbital angular momentum from the spin angular momentum. The rest of the evolution just continues the same way as it did before. I had the second star go supernova, but now the orbit is much tighter, the orbital velocities are so much larger, and the sort of imprint of that kick is marginal compared to the first kick from the supernova. So for binaries from isolated binary evolution, I mostly expect the spins to be, you know, near zero. On the other hand, dynamical formation is essentially a chaotic process. The spins are going to be completely isotropic on the sphere. And so, you know, I expect the sort of misalignment between the total spins and the, that was irritating, and the orbit to essentially be, you know, random in the cosine of the angle. And so I'm showing here the posterior distribution from the first LIGO detection. And what you notice is that what LIGO measures really well is this parameter called chi-affected. And that is essentially the projections of the spins onto the orbital angular momentum. So it's literally how much of the spins are aligned with the orbit or anti-aligned with the orbit. The sort of tangential projection of that, the projection into the plane, this chi p parameter right here, is very unconstrained and essentially goes from 0 to 1. Yeah?
Since the inner product, the spin went with the angle momentum.
Boom.
Around 0. The other possibility is the spins are very small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to get to in about a second. So the other problem, of course, with this is that you can't really distinguish between the spins being lying in the plane, which as far as LIGO is concerned is zero, or just having no spins. But that turns out to have a neat implication for the dynamical channel, which I'm going to come back to at the end. Because originally, you know, and I put this out in 2016, my sort of the first paper I had on this, the idea that I had was, well, imagine the spins are extreme, which is what we sort of thought from X-ray binaries at least. Then from dynamical formation, half the time you're going to expect the spins to have some anti-alignment with the orbit, and half the time you're going to expect them to be aligned with the orbit. So early 2017 comes around, and LIGO detects, this thing, which is a heavy binary black hole with some significant evidence of spin orbit anti-alignment. As they put in the paper, the posterior suggests a roughly 82% chance of spin orbit anti-alignment for this binary black hole. So at least an 82% chance that some component of the spins were anti-aligned with the orbit. And it's even more obvious if you look at what they call these spin or spin disk plots. So this is essentially the spin of the primary black hole, the spin of the secondary black hole, and the angle from top to bottom sort of shows what the expected spin orbit misalignment of the system is. The sort of radial component is sort of the spin magnitude. And so, at least from this, you know, if you squint, it looks like evidence for dynamical formation, because there's at least some evidence of spin orbit anti-alignment.
If you squint, that'll pretty good vibe for you.
Yeah, if you squint and you're also writing the papers on that, then it's, you know, very easy to convince yourself. Unfortunately, though, this posterior is completely consistent with having essentially zero spin. And with the exception of the Boxing Day event, all of LIGO's posteriors have been consistent with having zero spin, which means it is entirely possible that maybe binary black holes, especially those that LIGO ends up detecting, maybe the black holes themselves are just born with low spins. And so this is what a lot of people have been sort of poking at lately. And it's this sort of very, very annoying possibility, which is what if, you know, what if stars from stellar evolution simply manage to get rid of most of their angular momentum before they collapse, and you're left behind with a near Schwarzschild black hole that really isn't rotating more than maybe 0.1 in dimensionless Kerr parameter. And so the population synthesis people got around this by saying, oh, well, it's easy. We'll just draw a line from spin of 0.9 for black holes that'll become X-ray binaries, and sort of drop it down to 0.1 for spins of black holes that'll become LIGO sources. This was based on some models from the Geneva Code for Stellar Evolution, which I honestly don't fully understand how they track. Well, actually, quite a few things. I don't really understand how these codes work, because they're kind of very, very complicated and very, very difficult to follow. But essentially, you can make some sort of predictions for where the spins might be. I don't really trust a lot of this, because there's a lot of uncertainty in sort of the magnetic coupling between core and envelope, the sort of viscosity you get when the thing evolves under the giant branch, how efficiently you can radiate away angular momentum in stellar winds. There's just a lot of knobs you can dial on this to get a sort of get the result that you want.
So, Carl, just a question. So, in this, whether you're assuming that you, prior to supernova, you got rid of it, because if at the moment of supernova, you see some non-triggered angular momentum, it would be very difficult.
Yeah, so I think, I don't fully understand how these models work. My understanding is that the way you get rid of a lot of this angular momentum is that if the core and the envelope are very well coupled, then when you expand onto the giant branch, instead of, so I mean, if the core and the envelope weren't coupled, when I expand onto the giant branch, I get this tiny core, it's rotating very, very rapidly, and when it collapses, it translates all of that angular momentum into the spin angular momentum of the binary. If the core and the envelope are very well coupled, though, when the thing expands onto the giant branch, you know, I suddenly have this much more extended object, I translate most of that angular momentum from the core out into the envelope. And it's the outer parts of the envelope that are predominantly going to get ejected due to stellar winds and everything else. And so essentially the winds and the rest of this process can remove a lot of that angular momentum and the supernova too at the end, because that's going to blow off a large part of the envelope. And so I'm left with this core that is essentially not very rapidly rotating. And when that collapses, it collapses to a slowly rotating black hole. I mean, this is the sort of unholy convergence of a lot of poorly constrained things in stellar astrophysics. So, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainties on where this sort of lands in how this actually works. I prefer to think about it just honestly in terms of, you know, if the spins were low, what observational properties would that give us versus if the spins were high? And if the spins are low, that actually turns out to have a neat implication for globular clusters, which I'm going to get to now. So I'm going to take a slight diversion into sort of post-Newtonian dynamics real quick, and it'll become clear why at the end. So going back to this picture of binary formation, right? If I have two objects come in, I can't form a bound system just because of the energetics. I need some way to dissipate that energy and angular momentum. Now, in Newtonian gravity, I can just do that by having a third nearby interloping object. I dump energy onto it, and then I get a bound system. But, you know, what else is good at dissipating energy and angular momentum? Obviously, gravitational waves. So it is entirely possible that I could, if I have a close enough paracenter passage, actually emit gravitational waves as the two black holes whiz by one another, essentially creating a gravitational wave Bremsstrahlung effect. And so this is the same scattering encounter that I showed before, But now I've added relativistic corrections to the Newtonian equations of motion. So I have the 1, 2, and 2.5 pn post-Newtonian corrections, which roughly correspond to barycenter precession, higher order corrections to barycenter precession, and gravitational wave emission, respectively. And so already this encounter has changed from last time, just because it's a formally chaotic process, and I've slightly perturbed the equations of motion. But as you can see, like when these things are undergoing these resonant encounters, each of these black holes come within a very tight region, and they pass by each other many, many times, offering many chances for a close barycenter passage, until eventually two of them come close enough together that they can actually merge and create a new, heavier black hole. In this case, things merge on the timescale of this movie, so you basically didn't see anything other than a direct collision. But if I zoomed in on that and asked what did this look like, you know, on a sort of slower timescale, and I slow the timescale way down, you know, I actually end up, these two things whiz by one another, they form an extremely tight binary that'll end spiral in a very, very rapid timescale. So this is essentially that capture from this central region here, and I'm just showing about 90 days of it or so here. And on the top, I'm showing the orbit of the two binaries. You can't even see the paracenter in this, it just looks like two individual orbits are essentially touching, but there's actually a paracenter in there. And on the bottom, I'm actually showing the gravitational waveform from this system as it's being integrated. And so, as the system is integrating, the 1pn term essentially causes the orbit to precess very rapidly, which gives you these nice precessional modulations in the waveform. And then it very, very rapidly, you know, is driven to merger. And you can see on the top, this is happening on a very, very close timescale. So these things are forming, you know, with paracenter distances of maybe a few hundred m. Which is crazy on an astrophysical length scale. And so as this thing gets closer and closer to merger, you know, it slowly circularizes, starts to zoom in faster, until eventually the thing is actually driven to merger at about 90 days. Right about there. And so one of the things that's very neat about this is if you form these things with very high eccentricities, so where the paracenters are that close, can it actually maintain some of that eccentricity up into the LIGO band? So what I'm showing here is the distribution of eccentricities at a gravitational wave frequency of 10 hertz. Right now, I'm just showing what we call primordial binaries from globular clusters. So these are binaries that formed from massive stars that essentially underwent common envelope evolution. So you can think of these actually as field binaries. And in this case, the eccentricities are all very low. They peak at about 10 to the minus 7 in the LIGO band, and maybe go up to 10 to the minus 6 if you're lucky. Now, LIGO is never, ever going to be able to measure eccentricities that low. That's way, way too small for LIGO to be able to measure. But if I ask, what does the total contribution from globular clusters look like, I get something like this. And so there are three peaks, roughly, in this distribution. The first one is those binaries that are ejected from the cluster. They're all ejected with a thermal eccentricity distribution, so they start off slightly more eccentric than black holes from binary stars, because the gas drag in the common envelope essentially circularizes these objects. And so now I get a peak around 10 to the minus 6 here. The second peak is actually those things that merge inside the cluster, where I get a very high eccentricity during one of these encounters that essentially drives me to merge before a third interloping object can come by. And so in that case, I get a slightly higher distribution. But what's really interesting is this third peak out here. And that is entirely due to gravitational wave-induced captures. These events where you have these multiple paracenter passages during these three-body encounters, and eventually two objects can come close enough to where they essentially promptly form a binary and merge. And in that case, you can actually maintain significant amounts of eccentricity all the way up into the LIGO band. So from combining that cosmological model that I had earlier with new models of globular clusters that include all of the post-Newtonian physics you need for this, it turns out that roughly about 10% of binary black hole mergers from globular clusters will be forming as a result of gravitational wave bremsstrahlung. And about 5% of that is going to enter the LIGO band with eccentricities greater than 0.1. And so that already is a pretty good evidence for dynamical formation. If LIGO sees something with an eccentricity of 0.1 or higher, it is almost definitive proof that it formed in a dense, in some sort of dynamical environment. I should be careful here, because there are a lot of formation scenarios that predict high eccentricity, but they're all essentially dynamics driven. So you can get high eccentricity through Lyapunov-Kozai oscillations, either around a supermassive black hole or in a field trip. You can also get it through direct captures around a galactic nucleus, where you have black holes sort of orbiting a supermassive black hole and undergoing very close passages. But pretty much every one of those scenarios involves some form of dynamics. So there's really no way to get this from a field evolutionary scenario. And so this is already kind of neat, because if I add in all this post-Newtonian physics, I'm getting roughly 20% of my objects of my mergers are coming from in-cluster mergers, these things that get high eccentricities. 10% of them are coming from gravitational wave captures. So roughly about a third of all of my binary black hole mergers are occurring in the cluster. And this is where the spins come back into play. So if I have something merge inside the cluster, I have two masses that merge, I get a new black hole with a mass, give or take, the mass of the two progenitors, and a spin of 0.7, because I've converted all that orbital angular momentum into spin angular momentum of the new black hole. Now, if the spins of the black holes are high, then essentially the sort of way I'm emitting gravitational waves becomes very asymmetric, and I can get a very, very large recoil kick of the remnant black hole. And so for the typical masses you get from globular clusters, if you assume every black hole has a spin of 1, then the recoil kicks I get are hilariously large. They're anywhere from 100 to a few thousands of kilometers a second. The highest you can actually dial this up to about 5,000 kilometers a second if you get the right orientations of the spins. The typical escape speed for one of these clusters is maybe 10 kilometers a second to maybe a little above 100 if you're generous with your initial conditions. So if the spins of the black holes are high, all of these things are leaving the cluster. I'm not going to retain any of these merger products inside the cluster. But what if what LIGO is telling us is actually that black holes are born with low spins? What if the reason most of LIGO's heavy black holes have chi effect of near zero is just because black holes are born with low spins that come from stars? In that case, this distribution shifts to a much lower velocity. The peak of this is actually maybe about 100 kilometers a second, and there's this long tail that goes down to much, much lower recoil kicks. And in this case, I can actually retain something like 50% of my merger products inside the cluster. And so if I retain this heavy black hole in the cluster, I'm still in this dense region of black holes, I can find myself another partner, and I can merge again. And so you can actually talk about creating, in globular clusters, a second generation of binary black holes, where at least one of the components was actually formed in a previous black hole merger. Now, the reason this is interesting, apart from the fact that it's just super cool, is that we think from stellar astrophysics, there is an upper limit to the black hole mass you can get from single stars. Above about a core mass of 40 solar masses or so, you start to induce what we call pulsational pair instabilities in the star. And so for stars with cores more massive than that, you'll essentially undergo these radial pulsations that blow and ablate material off of the star until you're ground down to about 40 solar masses. If you're much more massive than that, so if the size of your helium core mass is above about 60 solar masses, you completely explode. You just get this massive pulsational pair instability supernova that completely destroys the star. And so because of that, we have reason to believe that there's an upper mass limit, or a mass gap, from about 50 solar masses to 135 solar masses, where you simply don't expect black holes to form from stars. Because anything that should have been in that gap from a massive star would have either been ground down by pulsational pair instabilities or completely destroyed by a pair instability supernova. And so this is from one of these population synthesis studies, and if I put this physics into the code, I get this nice shelf at about 80 solar masses. Because in that case, the most massive object you can get from a binary star is a 40 plus 40 solar mass binary. But if I can create this second generation of black holes in globular clusters, then suddenly I have a way to push into this pulsational pair instability gap. So this is the total masses of things you expected from the ejected mergers in globular clusters. It goes from about 20 up to about 85 solar masses. The in-cluster mergers are typically lower in mass, and that's mostly because the heavy black holes were kicked out many giga years ago, and so the ones we see today tend to be lower mass. But those in-cluster mergers have produced a second generation of black holes. And if the spins of black holes from stars are all zero, then I get this nice smooth distribution that goes from about 40 solar masses in terms of total mass all the way up to about 120 solar masses in total mass. And those are 80 plus 40 solar mass black holes that were formed through successive mergers of black holes in globular clusters. And now, of course, this is very sensitive to what you assume the initial spins of the black holes are in the clusters, because if the spins were slightly higher than this, you wouldn't retain as many of these merger products. And as I dial up the spins of the black holes, the contribution from these second generation black holes becomes lower and lower. And so that's sort of what I'm going to end on today, is this idea that the masses, the eccentricity and the spins are really the two good ways to sort of pull apart these formation channels. But if the spins of the black holes are low when they're born from stars, you can actually build up a second generation of black holes, potentially with more mass than what you would expect from black holes from single stars. And the really nice thing about that is those black holes are also going to, I mean, those binary black holes are going to be sort of a, you know, a numerical relativist's dream in a lot of ways. Their mass ratio is 2 to 1. The spin of the primary is going to be 0.7. It's going to be isotropic. It's going to have a spin that is, you know, misaligned from the orbit. You know, there's a lot of fun stuff to be done there. All right, and so that's pretty much the end of my talk. I'm going to throw up this movie that I created as it was actually part of my dissertation from an in-body simulation, but it was basically just it's just a fun thing for public outreach. It has no scientific value, but I like showing it when I take questions because it's very pretty to look at. And with that, thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions people have.
So in the second generation, so the masses that will become there will be, so the total mass will be larger, therefore we will see them further.
Yeah.
Can we conclude, or can you conclude something already, or soon?
So I'm working on that now.
Okay.
So if it was an 80 plus 40 solar mass black hole merger, and it was optimally oriented, LIGO's projected O3 sensitivity could see that it's a Z of 1, which is crazy. And so we're already getting to the point where we might have a better constraint on, you know, how many of these things are out there. The thing is, a lot of those constraints that already exist, so there's a neat paper by Maya Fishbach and Dan Holtz where they speculate that there is a 40 solar mass cutoff in terms of mass, but that does depend on assuming an underlying mass distribution for the black holes. And it assumes that it's basically uniform from 5 to 100. So if black holes followed a Saul-Peter mass distribution, so a power law m to the minus 2.35, then we would have pretty good evidence already that there aren't objects more massive than 40 solar masses. But because these second generation of black holes are not created at the same rate, and they're typically much lower in contribution in like merger rates than the rest of the binary black holes, so you wouldn't expect it to follow the same distribution anyway. I also don't really think that, again, I also don't really think that the Saul-Peter mass function is the right way to look at this. I think what we would actually expect to see, because my personal opinion is I don't think one of these formation channels is dominating. I think multiple might be at play, which is actually great for astrophysicists. It gives us a lot to do. But I think what we will actually see is that there will be essentially a shelf at about 40 solar masses, and there will be a small tail that extends beyond it, essentially tunneling into the mass gap. And I think from the ratio of those two, you should be able to put pretty good constraints on, you know, what are the contributions from different channels.
So I have one. So when you're talking about using eccentricity to distinguish between these dynamic freeform binaries, if LIGO detected a binary eccentricity of 0.1 or higher, it would be sort of a smoking gun that it was dynamic freeform. Would it be true to say that even if LIGO detected basically any non-negligible eccentricity, it would be dynamic freeform?
I think so.
Other formation, or the sort of primordial binaries, we're nowhere near even 0.01.
Yeah, so if we go back to this picture, I mean, if LIGO could magically measure things down to 10 to the minus 5, I think that would be a lot more arguable. Yeah, so if LIGO could get down to 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, I think that would be pretty interesting. My understanding is that, and this is mostly because they don't quite have the waveforms for it yet, or the search pipeline set up, that LIGO can't really measure anything below 0.1. And even then, they're not entirely sure how they would measure things above 0.1. They're pretty sure they could see it, but actually doing parameter estimation on it is still sort of up in the air. I sort of picked 0.1 partially because it's a nice round number, and partially because that's sort of the threshold where eccentricity becomes unavoidable in the waveform, as opposed to, say, 0.01, where it could be masked and correlated with a bunch of different parameters.
But
right.
It kind of suggests that maybe the need for a better, analysis
model. I think so. I mean, I think this is something that LIGO is interested in doing. I think their problem is they have a lot of very interesting things to worry about right now. And I think eccentricity is low on their list of interesting, interesting things that are happening right now. I think a search pipeline for this is kind of is going to be very difficult because you'd have to make it very thin and very thinly sliced in eccentricity, because it turns out minor changes in eccentricity induce very large changes to the waveform. But I think doing parameter estimation with it is something that people are looking at. So if LIGO detects something with their burst search or with their template-based search that's close enough to circular for them to find it, but not so close that it clearly looks circular, then they would be able to do parameter estimation on it and get a much better sense of what the eccentricity is. On the other hand, I'm not in LIGO, so I'm just guessing. But based on the conversations I've had with them, that seems like the most reasonable course they would take.
A lot more cluster data. Mm-hmm. Those clusters with edge locality. Mm-hmm. Determine their masses. Dispersion velocities is fairly well in the term of gravity. There's little or no dark matter. So, what is the evidence for the existence of black holes inside these objects, which are about 10 kiloparsecs?
So we see them, so we have seen one in radial velocity, and that one's pretty hard to get around, in that we detected one black hole with a stellar mass companion, and we measured the radial velocity of it. There are also several detections of X-ray binary candidates that people think of black holes in globular clusters. Dynamically, we think the imprint on the globular cluster itself is the size of the core ring. So from our modeling, it seems, and there's a really good paper on this by Kyle Kremer, who's a grad student at Northwestern. It seems like the number of black holes you have directly controls the size of your core radius. So your black holes segregate into the center, they sort of puff up the core, and as the black holes are ejected, the core radius sort of shrinks as the cluster gets older and older. We think that you only really get a sort of classically core-collapsed globular cluster, where you have, you know, this very, very dense central region and a density profile that essentially goes, you know, straight up to the center. We think you only get that once you've ejected all the black holes.
Measure losses.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to measure the core. You seem to put a zero.
In the core? So when I've seen this done, it typically looks like the velocity dispersion in the center is mostly flat. It's very hard to measure that in that central region. Well, it's also it's also difficult, right? Because you have to pick a center, right? And it's not immediately obvious how to actually do that. I usually, when I've seen this, it's like the innermost projected like 0.01 parsecs, or even less than that, where this starts to happen. One cheeky explanation for that would be, because you do see also the density sometimes also zooms, or the luminosity also seems to decrease a little bit right in the center. And I mean, one way to explain that is that there is this central contribution of black holes that you can't see. Yeah. No, I mean, we have not observed like 200 black holes in a globular cluster. We have good modeling reason to believe that they are there, and we have small detections of X-ray binaries and one radial velocity. But I mean, we don't, yeah, I would say that that's strong evidence for, but it's not proof.
That's one last question, but now I'm going on the other side of the mass. So there is this lower / knowledge or whatever certainty that there is no black hole, but there is a black mask. But could you not evolve your mechanism in the double transfer with now binary neutral stars, have them merge, and then have a factory of 3-4 sort of mass black holes that should be there?
You could, actually, and I looked into doing this. The problem is binary neutron stars are really hard to produce at the same rates as binary black holes. Because at least in our models, as long as you've retained a large number of black holes, they are essentially running the table of dynamics sort of in the central region. So a typical based on modeling, a typical globular cluster will produce maybe about 100 binary black hole mergers over its lifetime. You'll really only start to produce binary neutron stars once you've kicked out all the black holes. So once you've reached a classically core-collapsed globular cluster, then the neutron stars, the white dwarfs, and all that jazz start to undergo these crazy dynamical encounters. I mean, that does, you know, that does agree pretty well with observations. One of the best known binary neutron stars we have in a globular cluster is in M15, which is a very massive core collapsed globular cluster. The short answer is that yes, you can conceivably do it, and I was able to do it one time in one simulation out of about 100. So I got a merger that was, you know, I found a merger in one of these simulations that was like 3 plus 1.4, and it was from exactly that. But I think doing it at any significant rate would be fairly difficult. Nuclear star clusters, on the other hand, offer a slightly better opportunity for doing that, but then we run into the difficulty that modeling anything in there is a nightmare.
We're just going to your first slide. So, yeah, the fact that something in Rayford observations that have been noted for the liquid running inside doesn't mean that it covers everything.
Yeah.
LIGO has shown all these large mass black holes that people would not expect from the observation point of view.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and if LIGO detected something that was like 3 plus 1.4, I would definitely write that paper. But the rates weren't, at least from globulars, interesting enough to really speculate on, you know, at least as far as I was concerned. I think, again, nuclear star clusters might be a way to do this.
So going back to the previous question, if somehow you're overestimating how many black holes were in the globular cluster, and there were actually significantly fewer, would the neutron star rate go up then?
A little bit, yeah. But then you run into the problem that it's very hard to dial it up enough to where it can explain a significant amount of the LIGO merger rate. Even from one merger, like LIGO prediction for the merger rate is enormous. It's like 300 to 6,000 mergers per gigaparsec cube per year. And that's extremely difficult to explain with globulars. It's also coincidentally very difficult to explain with binary stellar evolution as well. I think a lot of people are kind of hoping that the LIGO merger rate comes down a little bit, because theoretically it's been very hard for people to get to that level. Fortunately, if you look at the binary pulsar, if you look at like the double neutron star observations in our galaxy, there was a neat paper from, I can't remember the authors, but like some of the well-known neutron star people that came out sort of last week or maybe on Monday, that basically claimed that, you know, based on improved rate estimates from binary neutron stars observed in the galaxy, they were predicting a lower merger rate than LIGO. They were saying that LIGO during O3 would detect maybe 0 to 2 binary neutron star mergers, which is a little more conservative than the collaboration's, we're going to be seeing one a month estimate. But, I mean, you know, O3 is on in 3 months, so one way or another, we're about to find out.
All right, last question.
What is simulation? You use the Newton's gravity, right?
Yeah, except for this last part where we included post-Newtonian terms, or radiation reaction in the scan.
The last state you need. Like in the beginning, you do the population of the merger, you use the Newtonian gravity. So in this case, because this is a big thing, you need to consider the speed of light.
Not particularly. I don't think we're really at the point. I mean, these things don't evolve on a time scale to where the like speed of light crossing time would be relevant. So the typical crossing time for one of these clusters is 10 to the 4 years, and they're about 10 light years in diameter. So the light crossing time is significantly lower than the dynamical crossing time. Yeah, it really only comes into play during these sort of very close resonant encounters. And even then, only if you're lucky enough to have two black holes pass within essentially the gravitational wave capture radius.
Okay, well, let's thank Carl again.
Well, thanks for having me.